from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Chris Beam was 29 years old, she unexpectedly became a foster mother to a teenage girl who had already been in 10 foster homes, who had run away, and who was officially categorized as hard to place. Beam was suddenly thrust into parenting and threw herself into understanding the system that had failed her daughter. The result of her research is the masterful new book, To the End of June. This hour On Point, one writer's personal examination of the American foster care system. You can join us on air or online. Have you been in the foster care system as a foster parent, a foster child, a biological parent, an administrator, a social worker, an investigator? What do you think of this nation's foster care system? Is it functioning or is it fractured? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts, is Chris Beam. She teaches creative writing at New York University and Columbia University. Her new book is To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. Chris Beam, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us, why did you decide to write this book specifically? What were the questions you were looking to answer?
Well, you know, after I fostered my daughter, Christina, I also had been a public high school teacher before I started teaching university, and I had several foster kids in my classes. And through that experience, I also met foster moms, and I met bio parents that had lost their kids to the system, and nobody seemed to think it was working. You know, I also met administrators and commissioners, and nobody at any point in the system, high or low, felt like it worked. And I looked into some of the numbers, and I saw that we were spending more than $20 billion a year, and I thought, how could this be? So I wanted to look a little more deeply at it.
Can you describe and help us understand the basic system of foster care in this country from when a child first enters the system until he or she is, quote unquote, released?
Well, the first thing to understand is that there is no sort of national picture. Every state and every city and every county is different, and that's based on the history of foster care, that it was sort of comes together from a jumble of different systems, and then it was nationalized, and each state then sort of holds each of these little agencies together. And so every state and every county looks different. But in general terms, what happens, and I'm speaking broadly here, is somebody will make a call when they hear about abuse or think that there's abuse or think that there's neglect going on in the home, and they'll call an 800 number and they'll say, you know, there's something going on in this house. And then an investigator will come and look and interview the kids and interview the parents and look in the house and decide whether there's abuse. How quickly that happens is again contingent upon where that family is. There are only 11 states, I think, that respond to those calls within 24 hours. So that varies. And then whether they decide that it's abuse or neglect, that varies completely. You know, it depends on the investigator, how old the investigator is, how much experience he or she has. Some people might think that an incredibly dirty home and no food in the fridge constitutes abuse. Some people might think that that family is just poor and needs help. So, you know, whether a kid's removed is really a subjective thing. But in any case, the child's removed, brought into a state agency, and then usually they call one of a number of private agencies that they contract with, and these are often very old private institutions that are often religiously based or, you know, used to be religiously based institutions, agencies, and the kid is then put with this agency and placed with a family, supposedly for a temporary period for the parents to get better. That's the idea. And then the courts decide whether the parents can get better, and the parents have to hit a number of milestones, go to rehab or go to violence management classes or do any number of things that the judges decide. And the kid goes and sits in a foster home or a group home or a residential treatment center or whatever. And then if the parents don't get better, the kid gets supposedly adopted. Now, this process can take years and years and years, or it can take a few months. That's the general picture. There are a lot of variations in there.
Right. And then so from your research, what are some of the deepest problems then that exist within that structure, within the foster care system?
Oh, there are so many. But one is that first moment of removal. And the decision whether to remove. In many places we're deciding to remove a kid, in my opinion, far too often and far too quickly. We think that, a kid is, quote, better off if he's removed or she's removed. And what we're seeing is that the trauma of removal is so deep and so long-lasting. I mean, if you imagine, just imagine personally, I mean, if you're a kid and there's, and even if there's neglect going on in the house, you know, and but then suddenly you're yanked from your house and put in with strangers with new smells, new sounds, new everything. Even if these strangers are decent people, even if these strangers are loving, it's terrifying. And that trauma lasts a long time. And all the kids, I mean, almost without fail, feel like it's their fault. They feel like they've done something to break some fundamental contract. So,
but
we
certainly there are cases where the trauma and the abuse is significant enough that it warrants that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But often, I think we're so scared that kids are being harmed at such a deep level, or where, you know, there's so many lawsuits and we're afraid that the state is going to be held responsible for not removing the kids because we have these big news stories about parents killing their children, and kids do die at the hands of their parents every day, that we sort of err on the side of safety, meaning take the kids out of the homes. Mm-hmm. And we're not thinking about the sort of psychological ramifications that happen mm-hmm. when the kids are removed. And there is abuse in the foster homes, and there is trauma that happens from those removals and from the years of lagging and staying in these foster care situations. So then that's the second point, is the waiting around in foster care for the parents to meet their milestones or for them to go through the heavy bureaucracy that they have to go through to get their kids back, or for them to decide whether the parents are better enough to get their kids returned. And that's how it causes sort of the slow destruction of a person. You know, we get these big news stories about the big deaths and mm-hmm. the big you know, abuses, but really it's the slow destruction of a soul that happens in foster care day after day. That's really really the problem.
You made mention of it, Chris, but one of the more heartbreaking round of statistics that you write about in the book is the abuse that children face actually in the foster care system. Can you discuss mm-hmm. some of those statistics, some of those numbers?
Well, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting when I started doing my research was, you know, my book is really narrative. It's not a policy book, and it's not, you know, I'm not making broad policy suggestions. There are really smart people that work in child welfare that have a lot of great ideas and are making really good changes. But what I found, you know, so what I did was I followed families and I followed kids and I followed them for 5 years. I followed a couple of families very deeply for 5 years, and I followed good foster families and that really loved their kids.
Yes.
And
yes.
To see more where the system was failing, because we could see easily, you know, where there were cracks. And what I heard again and again from these kids were, you know, were these terrible stories of foster parents you know, abusing them. There was sexual abuse. There was physical abuse. There was just the sort of, and then there was the sort of sad story of the mediocre flatlands of, you know, they didn't attach, they didn't connect. They gave them a bed, they gave them food, but there was no love, there was no support. And these kids had been through real trauma. And so what I found was doing the research that there really is very, very little data on the foster parents themselves. We have a lot of information about foster kids and all their demographics and how they end up and how they got there and, you know, the race demographics and the age demographics and where they come from and all of that. Mm-hmm. And foster parents, we really know very little. And what we do know is pretty anecdotal. We don't know a lot about who they are and where they come from. And you know, the thing is that we have such a shortage of foster parents
right.
that in general, we're pretty desperate. I mean, like Los Angeles right now is facing huge fines for not having enough foster parents, and they're keeping these kids, you know, kids that they remove from the homes in these sort of like conference rooms for night after night after night because they don't have families, they don't have places to put them. So we're removing these kids from their family homes and making them sleep in office conference rooms for, you know, it's terrible. So they're pretty desperate to get parents, you know.
Right. I'm curious. curious, what did you hear from the kids themselves about what they thought was most wrong with the system? I think often the adults do a lot of talking on the sidelines, but what are the kids saying? What do they think is wrong with the system?
Well, mostly what they say is that they get sent back to the agency a lot. So they'll get removed, and they often aren't told why. You know, people are reluctant to blame the parents or tell them what their parents had done or explain anything. So they're removed in a van. It's always a van. They're just endless stories of vans. And the kids are taken from their home and put into, you know, placed with strangers. And the kids are so scared. I have one girl, her name is Dominique, and she's a great kid, but her story is fairly typical. She was removed at age 7. She didn't understand why. You know, she loved her mom. Her mom was the only mom she knew. Her house was the only house she knew, you know,
right,
and her mom was using drugs, but that was the life that Dominique knew, you know, and so she was removed, and she was placed with a woman that she loved that she called grandmother. And meanwhile, her biological mother was trying to get better, and her mother did get better. And so after 5 years with this woman, grandmother, she was brought back to her mother, and her mother relapsed within 3 months. So rather than following Dominique's attachments and asking Dominique, who were you with? Where can we place you again? They didn't do that. They just saw that her mother was relapsing, put her back with a different agency, because the child welfare group contracts with 30 different agencies. They sent her to another agency and put her in a different family. And Dominique wasn't connected to this new family, missed her mother, and rebelled. You know, then she started a series of started wetting the bed, started rebelling, started acting out because she felt like she lost everything. She lost grandmother, she lost her mother. And that, unfortunately, is really, really typical.
But isn't that at the core here, the tension of these two philosophies between those who believe it's best to keep a child with the biological parent at any cost and those who say you should find the best person to care for that child, even though they may not be biologically related? Take the child out of the home, find somebody better to parent them. Can you describe those two opposing viewpoints?
Well, you know, I think that there are a lot of people that think that, there are those two extremes, you know, that say that a child is best off, you know, take the child out and find them a new home. And then there are those that say, you know, no matter what, a mother, we're talking about moms mostly here, because that's where we end up.
Right.
But the biological parents love their kids, and we need to do everything to support the families. I think that there is some tension there, but I don't think that that's always at the core of this. I really think that what I found, at least, there are a lot of people in the system that understand that at the extreme, there are biological parents that do not and will not love their children, and those parents, we need to remove their kids. The trick is figuring it out. The trick is having the nuance and the time and the energy to separate those parents out from the others, right? And then, so it's not really like it's not a philosophical battle that's at the heart of this. It's making things happen faster. It's following the kids' attachments. Like with that story with Dominique, what we were doing was the system was following their bureaucratic rules, was saying, oh, mom relapsed, put the kid in a home with a bed, rather than saying, wait, where was she attached? Where was she? Who did she love already? Grandmother was there. We could have placed her with grandmother and made it okay. You know, and grandmother was willing to let Dominique have an attachment to her biological mother and to her. So it wasn't like mother and grandmother were fighting. You know, they all could have worked together. So it wasn't a battle, the classic battle that you're talking about. It could have all worked together. It was actually the system getting in the way of Dominique's healthy life.
What was
which
just
is unfortunate.
For her, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let me get some calls in here. Cindy is in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Cindy. Glad you called. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I want to thank you for bringing up all these issues because they're really important. These things are very complicated. I'm glad you brought up the fact that there's a bureaucracy that gets in the way, because that's really important. Mm-hmm. I have actually had a very good story. I'm 47. I was in the foster care system in the 70s, mm-hmm. and I feel like it really worked for me, and I wish I hadn't been taken out of the system. I don't know what to say. I had the social workers actually asked me as a 5-year-old, they would take me to a home, and I rejected a couple of homes as a 5-year-old. Mm-hmm. They asked me what I wanted, and I ended up in good homes, and good stories. And if I hadn't had what I call these really good points of reference, I was in very highly functional homes, and I felt loved.
That's great.
Cindy, thank you. Chris Beam, would you say that that's an atypical story? Is that something that you heard often?
No, you know, you hear it, and it's great. And what's good about that is that it sounds like, in this case, there were social workers that were listening to the kid and asking the kid and talking to her, and that's really important. And when children have an attachment to their social worker, there are great, great case managers and great social workers out there that really care about the kids. And I want to emphasize that, because when we talk about the bureaucracy as this mm-hmm. big machine, sometimes it sounds like we're maligning some of the people that are in it, that are working with a lot of heart and a lot of intention and a lot of integrity.
Sound like Cindy had a happy ending, but the statistics speak for themselves, and a lot of it is not a happy ending. By age 19, I'm reading here from your book, 30% of foster boys have been incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Foster girls are 2.5 times more likely than their peers to have been pregnant. Mm-hmm. 30% of the homeless population in America was once in foster care.
Right.
So those numbers speak for themselves.
Right. And I think a lot of that, the thing that's really happened in foster care is that it's a really changing system. That's what's interesting about it. That's what's interesting to me, is that it's not this sort of static, flat place. And I think that's the way it's been portrayed often, is like, oh, it's sad. Look at that. It's sad. It's over there. It's sad. Let's walk away. And it's really changed, and it has been changing. In 1997, Clinton passed a law that said, look, we can't have these kids sitting in foster care year after year after year. We have to decide, like I was talking before, we have to either get them back home or we have to adopt them out. So if a kid's been in foster care for 15 out of the last 22 months, we have to get them adopted or send them home. So it was called the Adoption and Safe Families Act. When that happened, foster care changed fairly dramatically. We brought the numbers down. There are fewer kids in foster care. It's great. But the numbers also changed. The babies got adopted. The young kids got adopted.
Right.
And we shifted it to the teenagers. Now the teenagers, who by and large are considered unfortunately unadoptable, which is not true. They're great. They're dynamic. They're resilient. They're really funny and amazing. That's my pitch for foster kids, for older kids. But the teenagers are not getting adopted. So foster care has shifted into this system of older kids. I mean, not entirely, but it's done that, and the system hasn't caught up.
I think what you said in your book was half of teenagers have to be placed in institutions or group homes because no family will take them.
Exactly. And so when they're aging out, that's the term for it, when they're aging out from these group homes, not only do they not have resources, which is why they're ending up on the streets, but they don't have the love and the and family to fall back on, So they don't have that positive self-image that a family can reflect. So that's why we're seeing these sort of dismal numbers.
And the economic impact of child welfare cases in terms of adult criminality and mental illness and homelessness. I mean, the ripple effect is quite striking.
Right. Some people talk about that in terms of like $100 billion. So, we may spend $22 billion or $25 billion on child welfare directly, but then we're talking about the economic impact of $100 billion in splashback on the other end.
Let's go to Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Vince is on the line. Hi, Vince. Thanks for waiting. Glad you called. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. The comment I wanted to make, and it's from my experience 15 years ago as a foster parent. My wife and I had, in doing the interview and we're initially getting set up, we asked when they were going to do the drug and alcohol testing. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the Lincoln County, Wisconsin social worker said, we can't even talk about it. Mm-hmm. And from then until now, I don't know if those things have changed, but I clearly think that foster parents, at a minimum, should be some kind, somehow responsible to drug and alcohol testing. Mm.
Vince, can I ask you a question as a foster parent? Why did you want to become one? Why did you want that experience?
Well, we were, at the time, 40, 45 years old, doing well, working, and just wanted to fill that that space and time that we had.
And how was your experience as a foster parent? How did it go?
Oh, very, very well. We had a 12-year-old that went from our home to another foster home and on to adoption, and then a couple other children that came and went, and it was just a good experience with no idea where they went.
Mm. Vince, thank you. I appreciate your call there from Wisconsin. Chris Beam, adoption is the holy grail in foster care. Vince mentioned a couple of, or at least one child that went on to be adopted. How often are foster children actually adopted?
Well, you know, it depends. Not all foster kids are available for adoption. The idea of foster care as a whole, as an entity, is to bring the kids back to their biological parents as a first step. You know, we remove the kids and we want to bring them back. If their parents are deemed unfit, then their rights are terminated and then they're available for adoption. So not all kids are, you're right. You're absolutely right. Of those that are eligible because their parents have been their parental rights have been terminated, yes, it is the holy grail. And so we have. We have 100,000 kids right now who are eligible, who have no parents essentially, and every year, you know, only about 30,000 to 50,000 kids are adopted. So a big chunk are sitting there year after year, and of those, I think they wait 3 to 5 years. So they're waiting a long time and feeling less and less adoptable. And what's interesting is, you know, when kids are about 13 or 14, they get to choose their case goals, and they, you know, 70 or 80% of them will say, "I want to be adopted." And then by the time they reach 17 years old, that number drops to about 2%. Their case goal is to just age out. Their case goal is independence.
And what is life generally like for kids who age out of the system?
Well, they don't have anywhere to go.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, right. There was there was a Chafee Act. It was the Chafee Foster Care Independent Act of 1999, and that was the attempt. Congressman passed it to fill the gap, so to speak. You know, he was seeing all these teenagers coming in and sort of filling the roles, and he said, you know, we got to put more money into it. And what they did was they funded a bunch of independent living skills classes, teaching kids to write checks and here's how you fill out job applications, and then they gave them some independent living programs, like here's an apartment for a year or two, and we'll have social workers come in and teach you how to budget and so on. Mm-hmm. The problem is these aren't families, and when the kids leave these apartments, they're excited to get them because they think, hey, I've got an apartment. You know, by the end of my time in my apartment, I'll be a recording star or whatever. And that obviously isn't coming true. So when they're done with these short-term programs, they are relying on each other. They don't have the networks. They don't have the resources.
There's no anchor. There's no structure.
There's no structure. And foster care cuts them off. In some states at 18, some states at 21. So all the people that they've known are no longer available to them. And what they have is a collection of their friends. They're on Facebook. They're Twittering all the time. You know, they're doing that. They have their phones. But beyond that, they're pretty lost.
Here's Lorraine in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Well, the first thing I kind of wanted to make a quick point is what, and I found out kind of in a long roundabout way. I was in the I was trying to adopt as a single parent internationally for years, and found out through channels, and it's not really a well-known fact that you don't have to be a foster parent in order to go through the adoption process of adopting a foster child. So I adopted a foster child that was in the system for 15 months, And within that 15 months, she was in, I think they said 5 or 6 different foster homes. So they kept replacing her and replacing her and replacing her. Not really sure exactly why, but she's wonderful. She's 4 years old now. It was just a learning experience for me as far as being able to be able to do this.
Well, Lorraine, good luck to you. We're grateful that you called. All the best to you and that little one. Chris Beam, you were a foster mother. You are a foster mother. You became a foster mom at a very young age. You were 29. Did you have a sense from your first interaction with the system that something was broken?
Yeah, but I absolutely did. And I want to say, just as a quick comment to the last caller, that is a great story, and that is so – those kinds of things are possible. And what's so interesting is that that woman's daughter was very similar to my daughter in that the kids go through so many placements, and the reasons can be so varied. It can be a young caseworker that just decides, oh, this isn't quite a fit, or the foster parents can choose to send them back. And depending on the state that you live in, you don't have to become a foster parent first to adopt. There's Adopt Us Kids, and look up online and see the hundreds of kids, thousands of kids that are available for adoption. I mean, they show their pictures, they show their descriptions, and you can pick a kid. It's pretty intense, actually. So it's great that the previous caller, you know, brought in one, and they're great kids.
That's exactly obviously what you did with your daughter, Christina.
Well, it wasn't. You know, it was interesting. Yes, kind of. I mean, it wasn't my plan. I didn't. You know, I wasn't like the other woman who decided to adopt, was looking for a child and decided to. I was only 28. You know, it was not my plan. I was a high school teacher, and what happened was, my daughter was. Not my daughter then. She was a student, and she was in foster care in Los Angeles. And the group home that she was in, decided to move her, and she got put in another placement. And then she got kicked out of that one, and there was no more room for her. And they decided, well, we'll put her in juvenile hall for a while because there aren't any beds. And she and I were close, and she called me and said, I don't want to go to juvenile hall. I didn't do anything wrong. That I'm going to get attacked in there. Mm. And I said, no, that's outrageous. There's no reason you shouldn't go into juvenile hall. Wait, come here. You know, come sleep on my couch. There's no way you're going into juvenile hall, you know, where you're going to get attacked. And this is bizarre. So I brought her over, and then I talked to her, you know, caseworker, and she said, well, do you want to keep her? And I said, okay. So that's how it happened. Yeah.
Simple question. Do you want to keep her?
Yeah.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Chris Beam this hour about her new book, To the End of June. If so many terrific calls here, let's get a few in. Judy is in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Judy, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Well, I have a theory about foster care, and that is to make it similar to elder care waivers and PCA waivers and other waivers where in-home supports are provided so that an adult who may have an addiction problem can go to a day treatment program, but that the child's life is not interrupted. Mm. I do this type of work for people with disabilities. In Connecticut, it's as expected that over the next, by 2020, we'll need about 10,000 more people in the field. But it's far more cost-effective than institutional care. It's far more far less disrupting to family life. And if the system see its way clear to make some very, very, very significant changes, I think that we would have a lot fewer children that are out there and a lot fewer children who are victims.
Judy, thank you very much. Appreciate that call. Crispin, what about that? More in-home support, more like sort of the elder care model that Judy's talking about.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that preventive, upfront, in-home services are always better. I mean, study after study kind of show, first of all, kids do better in the home than when they're removed. It's less disruptive. It's always better. And we're seeing, you know, we're seeing a sort of sea change in foster care, actually. There's a state that tried exactly what she's talking about. I think Judy's talking about, which is Florida. And they changed the way that we do foster care, which is that typically – the way the funding works in foster care is a child has to be removed. It's funded on a per diem basis. So a child must be removed from his home in order for the agency to request money from the city and from the state and the state from the federal government. The child has to be removed to get that money. And so it's sort of a perverse incentive to remove the kid. Mm-hmm. That's what's been argued. What Florida did in 2006 was they set up a sort of waiver system, exactly what she's talking about, where they got a flat there are problems with this too, but overall, it's a much better idea, in my opinion. A waiver system whereby they accepted a 5-year program where they got basically $140 million a year every year for 5 years, and with that money, they could do all of the front end stuff that she was talking about, like bringing in support to the families. And if the family needed drug use stuff, they could get that. If it was an issue of child care, they could get that. They could assess what the family needed up front rather than waiting for the abuse to happen and then removing the kid. And we're seeing the numbers in Florida looking really pretty good. There's far fewer removals. They're still removing the extreme cases,
right.
And then in 2011, Obama opened that up, and 30 states and cities have applied for similar waivers where they can get their money up front rather than having to remove the kid in order to request that money. I think we're going to see some big changes in child welfare overall.
Judy, thanks for the call. Here's Millie in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Millie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just want to let you know that I do hope there are some changes coming, and I believe in the city of Virginia Beach, when the city got sued for $500,000 and won because a baby died in foster care, during this time that this happened with this child, I myself and my daughter, who's living with me, and our two granddaughters, were going through the system. Kids were taken out of my home. They knew the children were not abused at all. Abuse in my home is not even a possibility. But I didn't know. I mean, they were telling my daughter one thing, tell me another thing. And I didn't know they would lie to me, but they did. They lied to me over and over again. Luckily, I am an educated person who has really good support. And when I realized, my friend said, you know, don't you know what their mission is? To divide and conquer. I'm like, why? Mm-hmm. Why would they do that? Mm-hmm. So, long story short, $20,000 later, after I finally realized without an attorney we would not get anywhere because they will not listen to you in court, they will not let you talk. But I got a really good attorney, and he proved they lied. He proved that child, the children never should have been taken out of the house. It had nothing to do with the children. There was no abuse.
And so what was the outcome, Millie? How did it end?
The outcome is we got them back. Everything's good. We won our case. It went to a higher court, and the judge said they never should have been taken out of that home.
Millie, thank you very much. Chris Beam, your response.
Oh, this is such a sad story. I mean, and this is exactly, it caused trauma to the kids. It caused trauma to the parents. It cost great expense. This is we don't want to think of our child welfare systems as an antagonistic force, but so many families do. And of course, they think of it as they're child stealers, right? I mean, this is the old vision of child stealers. They come in and they take your kids and they divide the family and they lie to everybody. And what a terrible, terrible story. And yet, If things like that are happening, then of course they're going to continue that reputation. We need to shift child welfare into a place of support that comes in and helps families that are struggling, not somebody that comes in and takes the kids that shouldn't be taken. I mean, it's horrific.
Here's Joel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Joel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thanks for calling, Joel. Go ahead.
What do you want to know?
Well, tell me why you called. What do you think? What do you think about foster care?
You're talking about the foster care program. I think there needs to be a better screening process put in place.
My producer tells me here, Joel, that you were in foster care in California some 40 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, from the age of 9 till I was 18.
Oof. 18 different homes, 10 different receiving homes. I can only imagine. Must have been horrific.
It was.
And what was your takeaway after that experience as a youth?
Say again?
What was your takeaway, Joel? What did you learn? What would you tell the rest of us about your experience in foster care?
My takeaway? That I wouldn't put any child through that, or any of my friends. It was when I was taken away from my mother. They put me in a home where I was abused, and I was, you might say, like the black sheep. They, when you're a foster child and they have their own children, you get treated differently.
Yeah. Joel, thank you very much for calling. I wish you all the best. Joel's a story that, you saw many Joels, Chris, in the research of this book.
I did see many Joels, and that's, it's a terrible, terrible situation. And I think that unfortunately, there is abuse. There are foster parents that abuse, and there are foster parents that do exactly what he described, where they treat their biological children differently from their foster children. And part of that is inherent to the setup, which is that traditionally they've taught foster parents, you know, this is a temporary situation, don't attach to the kids. Now, some foster parents have thought that meant, you know, well, we're not attaching, so the foster kids get one set of food and our biological kids get another different set of food. You know, this is their cupboard, this is their cupboard, this mm-hmm. is their room, this is their room. And how do the kids react to that? They internalize that as, I'm not good, I'm not as good, I'm nothing. And then what do? They respond, they act out. And then they get sent back to the agency, and they're labeled hard to place. Like my daughter was labeled hard to place. Almost every kid is labeled hard to place after you've been in the system for a year. You're labeled hard to place.
Tell us about the woman that you followed in the book named Mary. I think she had, goodness, 11 children in her foster care.
Ultimately, she had even more. At any time, she'd have about 11 kids in her house. But then over the years, 30 or so, she's incredible.
And one of the things you talk about, and the reason she was successful as a foster parent, was you say she praised the children. Usually they had a lot of demands, but she provided them with structure, positive feedback. She said that was crucial. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Mary takes in kids she'll take in kids that have aged out. You know, she doesn't sort of follow the rules that foster care says that a kid is done when they're 18 or they're 21. And she practices what she calls moral adoption. So that means that, you know, if a kid hasn't been released for adoption, she doesn't even call them foster kids. She just calls them kids. She calls mm-hmm. them her youth. Mm-hmm. And she's never sent a child back to an agency. So as soon as a child comes into her home, that's her kid. And so that's her commitment. She's committed to that child. So just as though it was her biological child, you wouldn't throw a child out, ideally. Or there's no agency to send your biological child back to and say, this child broke my television, send him back. She doesn't do that. And so she also praises every kid. She every day looks for something to praise. And I think that's countering what they've been through in the group homes, which always operates at zero, starts at zero and operates in a deficit, which means that you're always getting marks off. You're always getting checks, and you just sort of starts to deteriorate your sense of self. And so she's always looking to build them back up. And she believes in her kids, and it works. It works over time. You know, they may come to her hard. They may come to her acting like they don't care, but inside they do care. They always care.
Here's Miriam from Perry, Oklahoma. Hi, Miriam. Glad you called.
Hi. Can I mention the state that this is happening in? It's not in my home state.
Okay.
This is in North Carolina. Our son and daughter-in-law live in the Raleigh metro area, and they had applied for foster children and been trained last year and received the children last August. They were 3 and 5. They were siblings, and they were told at the time that they would probably be adoptable. My son and daughter-in-law had no other children. This was going to be their family unit. Well, they began in February wanting the DSS there wanted in that county wanted to put them with a half-sister that's in another home. Both of the older half-sisters are in foster care also because they were sexually abused by a father. So the rationale was that they wanted to put the two younger children back with this 12-year-old mm-hmm. in another home that mm-hmm. is much less desirable. There are several emotionally handicapped children already in that home. So they removed them from my son and daughter-in-law's home this past July, like 2 weeks before their one-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. And my son and daughter-in-law are just heartbroken. They had big plans. They had just really nurtured the children, done so many things for them. And they had plans to do the adoption. And now it's just kind of all... It's in the court, family court system. They have hired an attorney because this DSS did not follow foster care policy. They broke all the rules.
Miriam, thank you for calling. Chris Beam, this is the kind of story you write about in your book. You hear this over and over again.
Yeah. You know, this is why it's really, really hard to make sort of global generalizations about foster care. It's that each case is so different and each case needs to be handled with such nuance. And, you know, North Carolina is considered one of the better states, right? I mean, no state is perfect, but North Carolina is supposedly a good one in terms of fast track to foster to adopt, in terms of getting the kids back to their biological parents and so on. But, you know, in every single situation, there are competing goals. And so one of the goals in foster care is to keep siblings together for understandable reasons. Another goal, which the caller's kids have, is to keep attachment strong. And that's totally right. Those kids that she was talking about have lived, it sounds like, for a year. A 3- and 5-year-old should stay where they've lived for a year. They shouldn't be yanked out from her son and daughter-in-law. They've had love. They've had nurturing. And yet some caseworker has decided, wait a minute, they should be with their siblings. Well, they should also be with their siblings. Somebody in here... Somebody with logic is going to say, wait, there's a way to make it all work. I'm sure the siblings can have visits. I'm sure we can make this work. But unfortunately, it gets thrown to family court and it gets thrown into the bureaucracy and the humanity is lost and there's a lot of hearts broken and a lot of lives get ruptured and it becomes a mess. But it's really about competing kind of rules and ideologies bucking up against one another. It's very tough.
What were the biggest surprises, you would say, that you uncovered in doing research for this book, Chris Beam?
One was really how little we know about the foster parents. You know, we had that caller, Joel, who clearly had a lot of trauma from his early life, 18 homes, whatever. You know, and he mentioned, I wish there was more screening. I wish there was more screening as well. And I wish that there were more incentives, actually, for foster parents. We have this big line that foster parents do it for the money. The money is so little. I think that there aren't a lot of parents doing it for the money. But I don't think we know enough about foster parents. I think that there should be more screening, and I think that there should be more incentive, actually, to be a foster parent. I think we should treat it with more honor and respect, and therefore we'll have a sort of higher quality group of people doing it. So that's one thing that surprised me, really.
And in your own words, how would you describe the foster care system now in its current state in the United States?
You know, I don't know that I have a complete bird's eye view of it to describe it that way. You know, I got in close in New York with a couple of families. So I'm not a policy person that can see the whole country. I think it's a really dynamic and changing and vibrant place. I think that from my perspective, it's broken, but it's also changing all the time, and there is a lot of hope.
And finally, what did you learn about the nature of families after all your work on this book with foster children, with foster parents, these wrenching situations and difficult decisions that have to be made? What did you learn?
What I learned was that staying is the most important thing, that really sticking it out, no matter whether it's your biological child or your foster child or your adoptive child, if you stay and love your child through thick and thin, really, it will last and it will work. That's what I saw again and again.
Chris Beam is the author of To the End of June, An Intimate Life of American Foster Care. Chris, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get an excerpt from the book and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to writer James McBride about his new novel, The Good Lord Bird. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.